Good day. Today's Friday, 28th November 2025, and before I turn to the substantive matters of this programme, let me return again to the rather disagreeable subject that I discussed at the start of my programme yesterday, which is this channel which is providing an AI simulation of myself, and which I noticed the video appears to be still viewable, though I would ask you please not to view it. To repeat again, all the videos, all the programs that I actually appear on are exclusively this one, this channel, and the Duran, and any other channel upon which, on which I appear as a guest. If you see any other film or program of myself in which only I appear, which is not one of those places, then I'm afraid it is unauthorized and has nothing to do with me. I say that because I now notice that there are short videos also starting to appear on YouTube, which also have extracts of things that I am saying, or I'm supposed to have been saying, and which supposedly are of me. And let me repeat again, these are unauthorized and they have absolutely nothing to do with me. The matter has been referred to YouTube and I understand that they are dealing with it. Anyway, with that, let's move on. But let me first of all remind you to tick the like button if, once you watch this video, you like what you've heard and decide that you want to indicate that fact. Now, yesterday, as I discussed briefly in my program yesterday, the President of Russia, Vladimir Putin, gave a news conference, and he gave it to the Russian media exclusively in Bishkek, the capital of Kyrgyzstan, where he has been present and where he was attending a meeting of the Collective Security Treaty Organization, which is the military alliance which Russia leads, which brings together a grouping of former Soviet states. It was an interesting meeting in itself, by the way, in which Putin discussed a Russian plan, to re-equip the armed forces of the various member states of the Collective Security Treaty Organization from Russian production. Anyway, I'm not going to discuss the substance of that meeting, but I certainly am going to discuss the press conference because it was extremely interesting. I would say, firstly, that Putin was in an extremely confident mood, and the reason that he was in a confident mood, as he explained at very considerable length, is because the Russian army is now advancing faster and faster on the Ukrainian battlefields, and the Ukrainian army is falling back and suffering ever heavier losses. In fact, Putin gave a rather interesting discussion about the problems that the Ukrainian army is facing. He said that the Ukrainian army in October experienced losses of around 47,000 men. By comparison, it was only able to recruit around 16,000. This is new people that it had called up. And it had also managed to return 15,000 other troops who had been wounded back into the army. Now, how he gets these figures, I'm not going to even try to speculate. But the point was that he said that this left a shortfall of 15,000 men that Ukraine was unable to fill in October. And in the previous month, he said that the shortfall was 10,000 and that the gap between the number of men Ukraine needs to recruit or to re-enlist in the army in order to fill the gaps, and its losses is growing greater and greater. The deficit between men recruited or men returned from the hospitals and the therapy places to the army and the losses, the deficit is continuing to grow every month. And he also said that this does not take into account desertions. And, well, I've heard similar numbers from other places. And by the way, a short time ago, Gordon Hahn, the American scholar, on the 23rd of November, did a major overview of the state of the Ukrainian army. And he said essentially the same thing as Putin is saying, that the Ukrainians are unable to make up their losses, that the deficit between the men they lose and the men who are brought back into the army every month is growing wider and wider, and that the new recruits that are joining the Ukrainian army are often elderly and unwell and poorly motivated and badly trained, so that the Ukrainian army is shrinking rapidly, not just in size, but in quality also. And Gordon Hahn's guesstimate, which is roughly in line with my own, is that the Ukrainian army, as at the end of this year, will be somewhere in the region of 250,000 men. And that assumptions that are made in Kiev about Ukrainian military units being staffed at 60 to 70% levels are completely wrong, and that in reality staffing levels are below 20% in many, many cases. Now that may be true, and it may explain some of the rather strange decisions that Zelensky and the Ukrainian command continue to make. They may be shuffling around what are in effect ghost brigades, assuming that these brigades are much stronger and have many more men serving in them than they actually do. And it is not impossible, by the way, that what is also happening is that the commanders or some of the men, some of the officers who command these brigades, given that this is Ukraine, are over-reporting the number of men who actually serve in these brigades, because that way they can pocket the salaries of some of these ghost soldiers. Such things have happened in previous wars, and there's no reason to doubt that they could be happening in Ukraine at the moment. So anyway, Putin was very, very confident. He went through a long discussion of the state of the battlefronts, which I will return to later. More importantly, however, he wasn't just confident, but he was also very informative about the diplomacy and about where he stands on it. And I can sum it all up by saying that Putin wasn't just confident, but he was also uncompromising. Now, the first thing to say is that Putin gave what I think now is the clearest explanation of what was actually agreed between himself and Trump in Anchorage. Now, I say this because there's been a lot of discussion on this topic. Lavrov has given various interviews and press conferences in which he said that an understanding or an understanding was reached between Putin and Trump on some kind of proposal that Trump made to Putin and which had been previously communicated to Putin in Moscow by Witkoff, and that the Russians had become increasingly exasperated that after they told Trump and Witkoff in Alaska that they were prepared to work with the proposal the Americans had made. The Americans for many months failed to respond. And, well, I've said often that I have no actual information on what it was exactly that Putin and Trump agreed in Alaska. But there's been much media commentary in the West that the Russians had accepted, or in fact, the media commentary in the West said that the Russians had offered to cease fire in Zaporozhye and Kherson region in return for a complete pullback by the Ukrainian army from Donbass. I repeatedly pointed out that this was, if this proposal was ever made, that it was an American proposal. About that, by the way, there is now no longer any doubt. But I've said in recent programs that my best guess about the understanding that had been reached in Alaska was that Putin had indicated that he agreed with this proposal. He was prepared to accept a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, provided the Ukrainians withdrew from Donbass. Well, I now think that is wrong. And I think that is wrong on the basis of this answer which Putin gave at this press conference that took place in Bishkek, in Kyrgyzstan, which was an answer he gave to a question put to him by Pavel Zarubin, the most important journalist in Russia, the one closest to Putin. Zarubin put to Putin a question about the progress of the peace negotiations, the Trump proposals, and this is what Putin said. Regarding the draft agreement, there was no draft agreement per se. Notice the use of the past tense. Rather, there was a set of issues proposed for discussion and finalization. In general, I have spoken about this on numerous occasions. Prior to my visit to the United States, before the trip to Alaska, we discussed this with American negotiators. He means Witkoff. And subsequently, a list of 28 potential points for an agreement was formulated. As I have already stated publicly, it was conveyed to us through certain channels and we examined it. And then he goes through a lot of the complicated events that took place after Alaska. He says, by the way, also, over the course of this press conference, how startled and taken aback he was by the American decision to impose sanctions on Rosneft and Lukoil, that this made absolutely no sense at all, given the understanding that had been reached in Alaska. But anyway, the point was that the 28-point plan has now been renegotiated by the Americans, or at least the 28 points of discussion had been discussed with the Americans and reduced to 19 points of discussion. And by the way, Putin's spokesman Peskov has now confirmed that the Russians have now received the 19-point list of points for discussion. The points I want to make here is that from all of these words of Putin's, I think we can now say with confidence that the Russians did not agree, Putin did not agree to a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions. I said at the time that I found it difficult to understand why the Russians would agree to a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions when they had managed to persuade Trump at the Alaska summit that there would be no ceasefire at all. It seemed to me that there was a contradiction between the two. Well, Putin's words at the press conference have, I think, now resolved the question. What happened in Alaska was not that the Russians agreed to a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions in return for a Ukrainian withdrawal from Donbass, but that the Americans set out a series of ideas for future discussion. In other words, they created a kind of agenda for future negotiations. And Putin said that he was prepared to work on the basis of that agenda. That agenda included an American proposal that the Ukrainians withdraw from Donbass in return, and that there should be a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson region. Putin did not agree in Alaska to a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson region, but he did apparently agree in Alaska to a list of agenda points for future negotiations, which would include that item. Now, that makes complete sense, and I think it resolves the issue. Putin, over the course of this press conference, however, now cast very serious doubt about whether a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions is any more of an appropriate point of discussion. And over the course of various questions, he said this, I will tell you now very briefly, I think it will be clear at once what it is all about. We are still receiving proposals about ceasing hostilities there, there, and there. When the Ukrainian troops leave the territories they occupy, then the hostilities will cease. If they do not leave, we will achieve it militarily. That's that. And elsewhere, over the course of the press conference, he refers to Crimea, Donbass, and Novorossiya. Now, Novorossiya includes, of course, Zaporozhye and Kherson region. Now, notice that there is no reference here, no reference in this comment to a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions. What he says is, we are still receiving proposals about ceasing hostilities there, there, and there. In other words, the Russians are continuing to receive proposals that they should agree to a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions. But he is now rejecting that proposal. When the Ukrainian troops leave the territories, and the territories are clearly the entirety of the four regions, he nowhere says just Donbass. When the Ukrainian troops leave the territories they occupy, then the hostilities will cease. If they do not leave, we will achieve it militarily. That's that. That is, in essence, the same position as the one he outlined in his speech to the foreign ministry on the 14th of June 2024. He said in that speech that there would be a ceasefire if the Ukrainians agreed to withdraw from Donbass and from Zaporozhye and Kherson regions. And he has again just now in this press conference reiterated that. As I said, I've always been puzzled by this apparent concession about the Russians agreeing to a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, given that it appeared to have been made at a summit meeting in which Trump appeared to drop the idea of a ceasefire altogether. So why would the Russians offer a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, or agree to a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions in that kind of context? And we can now see that no such agreement was made, Putin says so, and that in fact the Russian position remains the same as the one Putin outlined in his speech to the foreign ministry on the 14th of June 2024, that in order for there to be a ceasefire, the Ukrainians must withdraw from the territories they occupy, which are clearly Donbass, Donetsk and Luhansk regions, as well as Zaporozhye and Kherson regions. Now, I think that this is not fully understood in the media in the West yet. This is partly because some of the questions that were made to Putin over the course of this press conference referred specifically to Donbass, but Putin does not say in his answer that the Ukrainians must only withdraw from Donbass in return for a ceasefire. He clearly says the territories, and the territories clearly also mean Zaporozhye and Kherson regions as well. And I would add that these words of Putin's are completely consistent with what Lavrov has been saying over the course of his various interviews and press conferences. So, what happened in Alaska was that Witkoff came with a set of discussion points for future negotiations, and Putin agreed with those discussion points. He said that he was prepared to move forward to substantive negotiations based on those discussion points. And the discussion points have been further elaborated in the 28 points that we have seen circulating. And, well, we don't yet know exactly what the 19 points are all about, but it looks as if there's some retreat from some of the points that were set out in the 28 points, which included an agreement that Ukraine would revert to becoming a fully neutral country, that the NATO states would agree that NATO expansion would end and that Ukraine would not be admitted to NATO. There were discussion points about limiting the size of the Ukrainian armed forces. All of these are things that the Russians are happy to discuss, though, as Putin also said over the course of this press conference in Bishkek, there are many other things in these 28 points that the Russians find borderline ridiculous. He dwelt an awful lot about, specifically on one of the points requiring a statement from Russia that they are not intending to attack Europe. He found that preposterous and said as much, given that the Russians have no intention of attacking Europe. Anyway, he said that there's an awful lot in the 28 points that is nonsensical. Some of it the Russians can work with, but it will require very serious discussion. And he gave indications about the kind of negotiating team that the Russians would want to put together would put together in the event that the 28 points did lead to a substantive negotiation. And he's talking here, by the way, about a substantive negotiation directly between Russia and the United States. And he says this: obviously, the negotiator from the Russian side is the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. A number of people, Larry Johnson in particular, at Sonar 21, has been commenting that all of the interactions that have been taking place between the Americans and the Russians so far, between Witkoff and Kushner on the one hand and the Russians on the other, all of the contacts on the Russian side have been unofficial individuals, people like Kirill Dmitriev, who is not technically an official of the Russian government, and of course Yuri Ushakov, who is Putin's main foreign policy aide, and who is, by the way, a seasoned diplomat. He used to be Russia's ambassador to Washington, but who is not currently on the staff of the Russian Foreign Ministry. And Larry Johnson has said that it would have to be the Foreign Ministry that would be the lead agency that would conduct the negotiations. And he's absolutely right. And here we see Putin confirm this. The negotiator from the Russian side is the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. When we really sit down at the negotiating table and start discussing each of the proposed items in substance and in detail, the Foreign Ministry on our part, from the Presidential Executive Office, Vladimir Medinsky, aide to the President, who has been engaged in this topic from the outset, and I also include my other aide, Yuri Ushakov, to deal with current issues, to organise all this work. He's in touch with his American counterparts. But he cannot deal with all of this alone. The Foreign Ministry must step in, and to some extent, the Presidential Executive Office. This is a big, very extensive set of issues that need to be discussed, formalised and properly spelled out. This is the way it should be done. It's not that I think so, but it is never done any other way. Now, I have been arguing for basically since January, when President Trump first began negotiations, or tried to begin negotiations with the Russians, that in order to begin negotiations with the Russians, to conduct negotiations with the Russians, you need to conduct them in a very formal, structured way. You need to establish a proper, strong, well-organized negotiating team with experienced negotiators, backed by experts, including experts from the military, and the Russians will have a negotiating team of a similar sort, and the two negotiating teams will meet in plenary sessions, usually in some city or other. They will meet on regular basis. They will go through the various points item by item. Very often there will be disagreements and disputes on particular items, but over the course of these meetings, the points of difference, the points of dispute on the various items will be identified. The points of agreement will also be identified as well. Eventually, the points of dispute are narrowed, and then that's when the back channels and the unofficial contacts start to kick in. People meet off the record, have discussions off the record. Ideas are then explored over the course of these off-the-record discussions, and then they can be taken forward, more often as a result of meetings between the leaders. And this is the format that Putin is proposing here. He wants a proper negotiation with the Americans. He wants the foreign ministry to be leading the discussions. He wants a chief negotiator who will obviously be a senior official of the Russian foreign ministry. He wants the Americans to appoint a senior official of analogous rank to conduct the negotiations. And he's talking about a team of negotiators. The foreign ministry in Russia will make up the bulk of the Russian team, but Medinsky and Ushakov, notice not Dmitriev, Medinsky, the chief negotiator with the Ukrainians, and Ushakov will be part of the Russian team. And probably, if we're talking about back channels, it will be Ushakov who will be in charge of any back channels and any unofficial, off-the-record discussions that take place with the Americans. And to repeat again, Putin says, this is the way it should be done. It's not that I think so. It is never done any other way. And I think the Russians have been trying to get the Trump people, the Trump administration, the Americans, to understand this. They don't like this strange negotiations or sort of negotiations we've seen conducted over this year, when American envoys like Witkoff turn up in Moscow from time to time with various ideas and sets of plans, where there are impromptu meetings to discuss grain deals or 30-day ceasefires in the air or things of that kind. This is not the way the Russians like to conduct negotiations. They want negotiations to be conducted in a structured way. Putin apparently thought that Trump and Witkoff, and presumably Rubio too, in Alaska, had agreed to that, and that Trump, Witkoff and Rubio had put forward points of discussion, or if you like, an agenda items for these negotiations. The Russians said, excellent, this is how it can work. This is how we can take this forward. Let's go ahead and move forward with this. What we want you to do now is to announce your negotiating team, and we can move forward on that basis, and we can then see how this conflict can be brought to an end. And the Russians remain deeply frustrated that that has not happened. And to repeat again, Putin says this, it's not the way it should be done. It's not that I think so. It is never done any other way. It has to be done this way. Otherwise, this isn't going to work. These informal contacts, this coming up with ideas all the time, on the hoof, negotiations on such a complex issue can never be conducted, cannot be conducted in that way. They have to be conducted in this very formal way that Putin has outlined. I wonder whether the Americans themselves understand this, and I wonder also whether the Americans have the ability any longer to conduct negotiations in this fashion. Kautilya, the contemplator, in a brilliant piece that he wrote on his Substack blog, recently called into doubt whether the United States has the ability anymore to conduct negotiations in this sort of way. And over the course of a live stream that we recently did with him, the US attorney, Robert Barnes, who has very much his finger on the pulse of things in Washington, also seemed to doubt this also, too, because he said that the State Department is basically packed by neocons, and they don't really have the ability or the understanding, let alone the desire, to conduct meaningful negotiations in this sort of way. Anyway, Putin also said something, by the way, about the discussions in Abu Dhabi. He said that he'd only learnt about them when he arrived in Bishkek, and he was clearly taken by surprise. And he said this, I'd heard some noise on this score about the Abu Dhabi talks. He said there's nothing unusual or especially secret about the fact that Russian and Ukrainian special services meet. Our secret services, Russian and Ukrainian, have always been in contact with each other, even in the hardest times, and they're in contact now. What are they dealing with? Resolving a number of humanitarian issues, primarily related to the exchange of prisoners of war. And he said that, interestingly, that on our side, one of Russia's FSB leaders attended it. I'd suggested in previous programs that the main interlocutor with the Ukrainians in the talks in Abu Dhabi would be Russia's military intelligence agency, the organization known in the West as the GRU. That is not its Russian name, by the way. And I said that given that Kirill Budanov, the head of Ukrainian military intelligence, was apparently the lead Ukrainian negotiator, I thought that the lead Russian negotiator might be Igor Kostyakov, who is the head of Russia's military intelligence, in other words, of the GRU. It turns out otherwise. The head of the Russian delegation, the Russian group that went to Abu Dhabi to talk to the Ukrainians, to Budanov, was a senior official of the FSB, which is Russia's counterintelligence and anti-terrorist organization. And that, by the way, is a very, very interesting fact in itself, because I don't myself think that a senior official of the FSB would simply be going to Abu Dhabi to discuss with Budanov and the Ukrainians topics like prisoner exchanges. I've already discussed in many programs how it's clear now that there is a dirty war underway between the Ukrainians and the Russians, that there have been various assassination attempts by the Ukrainians, not just assassination attempts, but assassinations by the Ukrainians on Russian territory, how the Russians are now starting to take countermeasures. I've speculated that the recent murder of Andrei Paruby, the Ukrainian nationalist politician in Ukraine, might have had a Russian hand behind it. And I speculated about other actions that the Russians might have been taking. It seems to me far more likely that this meeting in Abu Dhabi was about the dirty war, because it would be the FSB, which, by the way, conducts intelligence operations on behalf of Russia in Ukraine itself, There are many historic reasons for this, which I'm not going to discuss in this program. They would be the agency, the lead agency, prosecuting Russia's side of the dirty war. And they would undoubtedly, if they were meeting with Budanov, who is has played a major role in the dirty war on the Ukrainian side, probably that is what the Russians would want to be talking about. And the Russians probably would have wanted to make clear to Budanov that if this dirty war continues in the way that it has been doing, the Russians will take further steps. And, well, I'm not going to speculate further upon what is an uncomfortable subject. But anyway, this is what I think the true topic of the discussion in Abu Dhabi was actually about. But anyway, Putin then continued to say by saying this, a representative of the US administration also came to the meeting. And that was obviously Driscoll. And as I said, I think Driscoll was probably tipped off by Budanov about this meeting and decided to gatecrash it. And Putin then continues, it was a bit of a, it was a bit unexpected for us, but we never give up on contacts. He spoke with the Russian representative and wondered if perhaps we should not wait until next week to continue contacts, but rather hold a meeting in Moscow this week. So the Americans, Driscoll, went to Abu Dhabi in order to get Putin to agree to receive an American delegation in Moscow this week. And Putin continued, I only learnt about this when the plane landed in Bishkek, but nevertheless I said that we were ready. You're welcome at any time. The issue is so important for everyone and for us that at any time of the day or night, we will agree tonight, we will return, so we can meet right on Thursday or Friday, Saturday, Sunday, whenever they want. So the Russian official, the FSB official, contacted Moscow. Moscow then contacted Putin in Bishkek. The Russians, the Moscow told Putin in Bishkek, Trump and the Americans want to bring forward the meeting with Witkoff, which is due to take place next week. They want to bring it forward so that it can happen this week. Putin said yes. He cut short his time in Bishkek and came back to Moscow, expecting that the Americans would come. But then what happened was, the latest information brought to my attention yesterday was that President Trump had decided, after all that is previously agreed, and there was such an agreement, the meeting proposed by the American side should be held in Moscow next week. Okay, we're always open. So Putin flew back to Moscow from Bishkek, cutting short his trip to Kyrgyzstan to meet with the Americans, only to be told when he got back to Moscow that the Americans had had second thoughts and had decided that they would stick with the original agenda of holding the meeting in next week in Moscow after all. Further evidence, if you like, of the disorganization and chaos and muddle on the American side. Putin is making light of this. Ushakov, his aide, is not. The Russians do not like the way in which the meeting in Abu Dhabi was made public. And if it really was a meeting about the dirty war, not just about prisoner exchanges, one can see why. And by the way, I'm not saying that there weren't discussions about prisoners. And there's been much speculation that I'm aware of, that one of the reasons Budanov went to Abu Dhabi was in order to try to get the Russians to agree to the release, to the extraction from the Pakrovsk area of whatever important person or persons have been caught in the cauldron there, and which Budanov, with his Black Hawk helicopters and his special forces, whoever it was that they were unable to extract in that failed venture of a few weeks ago. Of course, all of this is very speculative. And anyway, all of that may be true. But anyway, I don't think it was about prisoner of war exchanges, though no doubt that was discussed. But the presence of an FSB official suggests to me it was a discussion of the dirty war, and the Russians are furious that a discussion on a topic like this was made public, and they are unhappy that Putin cut short his visit to Bishkek and rushed back to Moscow, expecting to meet an American delegation that was coming to see him, only to discover that it wasn't turning up after all, but would only be coming to to Moscow next week. Now, on this last point, I don't think it's particularly difficult to understand why that has happened, because despite denials in Washington, there's clearly tensions about this whole topic, this whole issue. The word that has appeared in the media is that Witkoff and Kushner worked together on sorting out the 28 points, that it was then taken to Vance. Vance approved it. Vance then took it to Rubio. Rubio went over it, said this is fine, and that everybody in Washington is working together as part of the same team. I think already the way that's been set out calls that whole narrative into question, because why would Witkoff and Kushner report to Vance on a diplomatic matter of this kind rather than Rubio directly, given that Rubio is the Secretary of State and Donald Trump's national security advisor? Just saying. But anyway, clearly there's uncertainties and probably disputes on the American side. But perhaps the single biggest reason why there's been this delay on the American side is because the Ukrainians and the Europeans continue to cause problems. We will come to that shortly. Anyway, Putin then also made a number of further points about the discussions and what the negotiations would be all about. And he made it very clear again that one of the things that he and the Russians are looking for is recognition, formal recognition, at least from the United States, of the territorial changes. He said this quite explicitly. He said that there must be recognition, and that this is an absolutely essential part of the discussion. This is the question put to him by a journalist, Valentin Alfimov. You have already partially addressed this, but I would like to clarify the legal aspect concerning Crimea and Donbass. In President Trump's plan, it is stated that they recognize these territories as ours de facto, but not de jure. How is that possible? I don't understand how that's possible, by the way. And anyway, Alfirov then continues, as a lawyer, how do you see this distinction? How can something be recognized de facto, but not de jure? And Putin comes back. This is precisely one of the issues that should be addressed in our negotiations with the American side. Thank you for drawing attention to it. You are right. This is one of the key points. So there has to be recognition. He goes on to say, elsewhere, we need recognition, but not from Ukraine as things stand today. I hope that in the future we will be able to work out a deal with Ukraine as well. But he says that there is a difference between decisions under which certain territories remain under Russian sovereignty have been recognized. It's essential that this be cleared up, because if agreements get violated, it will constitute an attack on the Russian Federation, with all ensuing responses from Russia. And the alternative of not sorting out the question of recognition would leave open the possibility that an attack by Ukraine in, say, Zaporozhye or Kherson or Donbass regions or Crimea could be interpreted by Ukraine as an attempt to restore law on the territory owned by Ukraine. We need recognition. And the question of de facto and de jure, whether it's de facto or de jure recognition, these strange ideas that the Americans are coming up with, that needs to be sorted out and settled as well. So anyway, there we go. Now, Putin did say many other things. He talked about the whole question of the confiscated Russian assets. He made it absolutely clear that the Russians are completely unimpressed, to put it mildly, in fact, implacably hostile to all of the various ideas that are floating around Europe at the moment. And he said something else as well. He also said that the reason why there's been this sudden rush to get this whole process of negotiations restarted is because of the situation on the front lines. And he discussed this at very, very great length over the course of his press conference. He went into detail about what is going on in various locations along the battlefronts. I'm not going to go to what Putin said about this, because one of the curious things about his comments at this press conference on this topic is that it's absolutely clear to me that Putin, in order to understand what is going on the battlefronts, relies on reports that he gets from the general staff. And whilst he is in Bishkek, and of course this press conference took place in Bishkek, whilst he is in Bishkek, he's not able to receive these reports. So that the update, the information he's been getting, is 1 or 2 days out of date. Anyway, I will return to this shortly. But he is saying very clearly, very straightforwardly, that it is the military situation, the military crisis that Ukraine is currently facing, which has galvanized the Americans suddenly into restarting the negotiations. So here we go. We could summarize this all up as follows. The Russians have not conceded it on any of the points Putin made on the 14th of June 2024. They never agreed to any changes on any of the points that were made there. What they agreed with Trump and Witkoff and Rubio, by the way, in Alaska was a series of discussion points, an agenda, if you like, for a substantive negotiation between properly organized negotiating teams, which they were expecting to begin in the weeks after the summit meeting in Alaska. And they were very frustrated and surprised that the Americans never put together a negotiating team and never suggested any mechanism to take the agreement on the agenda items after that was reached in Alaska, never took that forward. They've now received a new set of agenda items, which has some changes from the Alaska list of agenda items, but is something that the Russians can work with, and that's the 28 points. Today, they've also received the 19 points. Witkoff is supposed to be coming to Moscow to talk about all of this with Putin. Driscoll gate crashed a secret meeting, and it clearly was a secret meeting, despite what Putin says, in Abu Dhabi. A secret meeting between top Ukrainian and Russian intelligence officers, which I believe was about the dirty war. Anyway, Driscoll gatecrashed this meeting in order to try to get Putin to agree to meet an American delegation of Witkoff, Kushner, and presumably himself this week. Putin said yes. He cut short his trip to Bishkek, was ready to fly back to Moscow to meet the Americans, only for the Americans then to change their minds and to say, well, actually, we're coming next week after all. And probably, as I said, the reason for that is that the Ukrainians and the Europeans continue to dig in their heels and continue to make demands and points which it translated into negotiations would make any prospect of those negotiations going forward impossible. And in fact, we've had lots of statements. So we've had a statement from Mark Rutte, the NATO Secretary General, and he repeated the mantra that Russia has neither a veto nor a vote on any question relating to NATO membership and NATO expansion. So, in other words, Ukraine still can join and should join NATO, which, of course, cuts completely across Russia's red line. Zelensky has said that there is no question of Ukraine giving ground, surrendering any part of its territories. Yermak, Zelensky's all-powerful chief of staff, has given a long interview to Simon Schuster for The Atlantic, in which he has said that there is no question of Ukraine surrendering any territories, and this is a topic which is not even being discussed in Kiev. The Ukrainians, in other words, are digging in their heels. The Europeans are digging in their heels. Macron and Starmer still talk about sending troops, European troops, to Ukraine. They're still making impossible demands. And this is the reason why, for the moment at least, the Americans are having problems getting their team, their own delegations, to negotiate with the Russians organized. And of course, as I've discussed in recent programs, there's massive reaction within the United States against this entire process as well. There's been strategic leaks planted in the media. Putin discussed those and went out of his way, by the way, to defend Witkoff and cast doubt on the authenticity of the leaks. But anyway, there's been strategic leaks, which, again, appeared to be intended to imply that the 28 discussion points were drawn up by the Russians, which the administration has gone out of its way to deny. There have been the comments by members of Congress, Mitch McConnell and Senator Warner and Lindsey Graham and all of those people. There's been the criticism in the media. All of this is working together to make this entire process incredibly difficult and all but impossible. There is another reason, a further reason, why the Europeans and the Ukrainians must be incredibly alarmed by what is being proposed here. Let us go back to what Putin said over the course of this press conference. Firstly, note that he's talking about the Russians putting together a negotiating team led by officials from the Russian Foreign Ministry, but also including the executive office, in other words, his own administration, and including people like Medinsky and Ushakov, and meeting an American team. And he said he was careful to say that it's not for him to decide who should be on the American team. But what does that mean? It means a direct negotiation about the conflict in Ukraine between the United States and Russia. Up to now, the negotiations have been between Russia and Ukraine. What is being discussed here is a negotiation between Russia and the United States to resolve the conflict in Ukraine. A negotiation conducted over the heads of the Ukrainians and of the Europeans as well. No wonder the Europeans are furious. No wonder the Ukrainians are shocked and frightened and very alarmed. Of course, it is what has happened in previous wars in which the United States has been involved. It happened in the negotiations to achieve the armistice in the Korean War. It happened in the Paris negotiations when the United States negotiated directly with the North Vietnamese to end America's direct involvement in the war in Vietnam. And, of course, it also happened in the negotiations between the United States and the Taliban to end America's involvement in the conflict in Afghanistan. The Americans and the Russians are now talking again seriously about doing the same thing. And that takes away the veto that the Ukrainians and the Europeans up to now have had over the entire negotiation process. And it opens the way for a deal to be done between the Americans and the Russians over the heads of the Ukrainians and the Europeans. And given that that is so, it is completely unsurprising why the Europeans and the Ukrainians are so shocked and alarmed. Now, so far, that has not happened. And frankly, given the difficulties, it might never happen. But this to repeat again, is what we are talking about. Specifically, what we are talking about here. So this is one important thing, one important reason why the Europeans and the Ukrainians are so alarmed by this process. But there is another reason as well. And it is again set out in the press conference, because Putin went into a lengthy discussion again about the government of Ukraine. He again said, in effect, that Zelensky and the current government have no legitimacy, that they have no constitutional right to be in power, that Zelensky's term expired in May 2024, and that Zelensky is not, therefore, the legitimate president of Ukraine and is not in a position to sign a peace treaty. And Putin again said that in order for a peace treaty to be signed, there have to be elections in Ukraine to restore constitutional and legal government and to provide for a president and a parliament which can legitimately and constitutionally sign off on any deal and ratify it in a way that would make it a binding international treaty. So that is already disturbing for the Ukrainians. But then Putin continued by saying that if such elections took place, he firmly expects the current group that is in power in Kiev to lose, and that the only way that this group, which is currently in power in Kiev, could win the elections would be through vote rigging. So what Putin is calling for here is regime change in Kiev. He's saying that this bunch, this group of people who he's previously referred to as a criminal gang, who have usurped power, they have no right to be there. They cannot sign a treaty. They are unable to win elections. If they win elections, that means that the elections have to be bogus, because who would vote for people like this? This is a call for regime change in Kiev. And again, the Ukrainians and, of course, the Europeans, who, to be very clear, back Zelensky, would be appalled if any kind of process like this, with a predetermined outcome, in other words, a predetermined outcome, which would be the ouster of Zelensky and his team from power, were to be set up. So this is the direction that the Russians want the Americans to take. Will the Americans take it? I have my very great doubts. And given all of the problems, given all the resistance from the Ukrainians and the Europeans, and given the extent of Putin's demands, which, as I said, are uncompromising, Russia's demands, which are uncompromising, it's entirely unsurprising that the Ukrainians and the Europeans are obstructing the process, and that there are doubts about it on the American side and massive opposition on the American side. And this explains the delay in getting Witkoff and Kushner and Rubio and whoever at Driscoll and whoever else is going to Moscow, why it's taking time for them eventually to go. I ought to say that the delegation, the American delegation that goes to Moscow, ought to be led by Rubio, a Secretary of State. It is a worrying matter that he has never gone to Moscow up to now. And I, for one, will not believe these assertions that Rubio, Vance, Witkoff, Kushner and Driscoll are all working together as a single team, unless Rubio goes and leads the delegation, the American delegation, as he should, and conducts serious negotiations with the Russians next week as America's Secretary of State and as the President's National Security Advisor. Anyway, that's what I'm going to say about Putin's press conference. I've gone into it in great detail, but I hope you can see why I think it's been one of the most interesting press conferences that we've had up to now. Putin, as I said, has given us very much an idea, finally, about what is going on. We've even, as I said, had some light cast, interesting light cast, of what happened in Abu Dhabi. And, well, as I said, there's an awful lot to see. Now, in the meantime, I should say that the investigations, the corruption investigations in Kiev continue. This morning, even as soon as Yermak had finished giving his interview to The Atlantic, investigators from NABU and SAPO once raided Yermak's residence. One wonders what they were looking for. Zelensky, however, continues to stick by his team. I do not believe, contrary to what most people think, that these investigations, these corruption investigations in Kiev, are being organised and run by the United States. I might be wrong about that, but I continue to believe that this is an internal power struggle going on in Kiev, an internal power struggle in which the Europeans continue to back Zelensky. And the other thing to say is that even as the pace of the diplomacy intensifies, Moscow is becoming the world capital of diplomacy at the present time. Even as I'm making this program, Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary, is in Moscow, where he is meeting President Putin. And another very senior official, Wang Yi, the Foreign Minister of China, is also coming to Moscow next week, where he will undoubtedly be expecting to meet with Putin. And obviously, Wang Yi is there to discuss many issues because Chinese-Russian interactions are on an enormous scale. But obviously, they will definitely be talking about the conflict in Ukraine. Though, as I've also discussed in my program yesterday, China is at the moment in a particularly agitated mood in light of the extremely inflammatory comments that the new Prime Minister of Japan has been making. On that front, by the way, which I discussed yesterday at length, I ought to say that there are now reports in the American media that President Trump has finally grasped the gravity of the situation with China and that he has telephoned the new Prime Minister of Japan and told her to dial down the rhetoric with China, in which case it looks as if the warnings from President Xi Jinping of China have finally been heeded. Anyway, that's the situation with the diplomacy at the moment. There's an awful lot going on, and much more is going to happen, no doubt, over the next couple of days. Now, to repeat again what I've said many times, and what no less a person than President Putin has now said, it is the military situation on the battlefronts which is all important and which is driving forward events. And I have only a short amount of time now to discuss these, but events are moving very fast, faster and faster on the battlefields. The Russians have just announced an extraordinary number of places that they have captured in Donbass over the last couple of the last 24 hours, and also in Zaporozhye region as well. So in Donbass, the Russian Defense Ministry has said that the Russians have liberated Zvanovka. Zvanovka is located close to Siversk, Petrovskoye, Ivanopolye, and Vasyukovka. I'm not going to pretend I know where all of these places are, but that's four settlements in Donbass liberated over the course, or captured, if you prefer, over the course of the last 24 hours. And the Russians also say, the Russian Defense Ministry says, that they have also captured four places in Dnepropetrovsk and Zaporozhye regions: Tikhoye, Otradnoye, Zatishe, and Novoye Zaporozhye. Eight villages over the course of 24 hours. I'm not going to say that's unprecedented, but that is extremely rapid. I think you'd have to go back to 2022, the first weeks of the special military operation, to see a Russian advance taking place so fast. Anyway, more advances appear to be taking place in more and more places. The Russians say that they have secured more territory in Pokrovsk. They say that within Pokrovsk, 6,585 buildings have been mopped up of Ukrainian troops. I don't think that this implies that it's just those buildings. And I ought to say that we've had a significant amount of information about the situation in Pokrovsk over the last 24 hours. And cumulatively, it suggests that Russian positions in Pokrovsk are exactly as they where they appeared to be just a few days ago, that the Russians have indeed cut off the Ukrainian forces in Mirnograd, and they appear to have consolidated control in northern Pokrovsk, and that all of the various claims of successful Ukrainian counterattacks in Pokrovsk, they'd look like they were wrong or false, or at any rate exaggerated. So the Pokrovsk-Mirnograd situation looks as bad as ever, and it looks as if the Russians are tightening their grip in Mirnograd too. And what I consider to be the most reliable maps seem to show to me only a small circle of places, a small area of the Pokrovsk cauldron still under Ukrainian control, basically in northwestern Mirnograd. Putin, over the course of his press conference, said that the Ukrainian troops located to the east of Kupiansk, who are still in a cauldron, look increasingly now like homeless beggars, that the conditions in which they find themselves have reduced them to that level. He says that there's 3,500 of them. That's his estimate of the Ukrainian troops who are still trapped east of Kupiansk, basically in open fields. He spoke about the Russians being 2.5 kilometers from Gulyapolye, but an accumulation of reports say that the Russians are indeed now fighting inside Gulyapolye itself. Apparently, Ukrainian troops fled from the advancing Russian forces in positions they held to the east of Gallipoli, and there are some reports that resistance in Gallipoli is collapsing. And Putin said that the Russians now control around 1,700 buildings in Siversk out of the 8,000 buildings located in that town. My own guess is that the number of buildings that the Russians have now captured in Siversk has increased further. I will do a more detailed discussion of the military situation in my next program. But the point is that the Russian offensive is accelerating. The Ukrainians are unable to hold back the Russians in any position. And as I discussed at the start of this program, the Ukrainian army is gradually wasting, not gradually, is rapidly wasting away. It's debatable whether Zelensky and Yermak fully understand the extent to which this is happening. And perhaps even the Americans don't fully. But time is short. The months wasted since the meeting in Anchorage could turn out to be decisive in terms of the future of the war. The pace of the Russian advance having accelerated since Anchorage, and the Ukrainian position having reached now something not far from the brink of collapse. I wonder whether, even if there were no obstacles strewn in the way of talks, and of course we know that there are, even if there were no obstacles strewn in the way of those talks, whether there would be enough time to get a proper negotiation going and to iron out all of these many contentious issues and to reach an agreement and to do a deal and then to ratify it before the collapse in Ukraine comes. But anyway, there we are. This is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.